So I'm clowning with some friends. And everyone goes around and gives a few adjectives to describe someone at the table. One woman gets thoughtful, kind. A guy gets musical, neurotic. Then it's my turn and people start shouting out, absurd, loony, crazy extroverted. And my wifey starts laughing. He's got you all fooled. He's not an extrovert. He's a super introvert who overcompensates. Huh? I start to argue, actually open up my mouth to say, how dare you, but I think about it. And with everyone staring at me, I have absolutely nothing to say. Today, from WNYC, Snap Judgment proudly presents Lost for Words. Amazing stories from real people who've got nothing. My name is Glenn Washington. Never let your friends tell you what they really think unless you want to hear what they really think. Because you're listening. Listen. Snap Judgment. Today, we're going to dive into situations where if there is a proper thing to say, our heroes don't know what it is. And we're going to start off in one of the most unlikely arenas of all to face just this situation, politics. Fair warning, if any of you are writers or you just love the written word, this one's going to hurt. Snap Judgment's Joe Rosenberg has the story.
To say that Barton Swaim loves a writing would be an understatement. Barton is the kind of guy who still remembers the day back in grade school when he was taught how to diagram sentences.
And the whole class was moaning about it. Everybody was dying. It was so awful. And I thought it was the easiest and the best thing I'd ever done. It was so much fun. There was just something about putting words together that gave me some kind of sense of power that I didn't have. And since then, I knew I wanted to do that and nothing else.
Okay, so flash forward a few years. Barton is a struggling writer working in a library in a small southern state, which, for reasons soon to be obvious, shall remain nameless.
And I opened the state newspaper and there was an op-ed by the governor. And it said, Bolton, our third son, has always liked the story of the three bears. Work has begun on the state budget. And because that means hot, cold, or just right, now deals with your money, it's worth sizing up whether or not you think things are indeed right in this year's budget. I thought I had never read a worse opening. Hot, cold, or just right, now deals with your money. How does it deal with my money? It's so confusing. I'm even confusing myself thinking about it.
So Barton decided to write the governor a quick little letter.
And I forget the exact wording, but it was something like, you need a writer, please hire me. And it worked.
Okay, so maybe it wasn't that easy. There was a job interview, a few writing tests, but the bottom line is that Barton Swaim, the once little boy who had always wanted his words to have power, was suddenly the newest speechwriter for the most powerful politician in the state.
So when I first came into the office, you know, I was sort of overawed. I'd never talked to a governor before. He was famous and charming and good-looking. But we all sat down and there was silence for a long time. And eventually he started to say something like, ooh, ooh. And I thought there was something wrong because he looked up at the ceiling and kept saying, ooh. And then finally he looked at me and he looked at the chief of staff and said, ooh. What are we doing here? And that should have been a warning sign. But, you know, after that, he was fine. And we hit it off. You know, I felt like at last I'm doing the thing that I was meant to do. And then one day he told me to write an op-ed on the state budget. And I think I wrote for hours, making every sentence just right. But he looked at the document we had given him and he stormed into the office. The first thing he said was, again. When he was really frustrated with you, he would begin what he had to say with the word again, as if he had said this to you before. But again, I would never say this. And he said that he would write it himself.
Then the governor handed Barton back the final draft of the op-ed.
And I just saw this really bad writing, and I was sort of inwardly devastated. And I looked at Nat, the other speechwriter, and said, wait, are you kidding? This is the way we're going to write? And Nat seemed not at all fazed by this. And he said, welcome to hell. And so this is the way every one of my products would go. I would labor on it endlessly. He would hate it. He would rewrite it badly.
And it wasn't just that the governor was hard to write for. He was hard to work for, too. Like, really hard.
The first time I took a trip in the car with him, I'm sitting in the back. He's reading the newspaper in the front seat. And when he's done with a section of it, he throws it into the back seat. And, you know, I get slapped in the face with the Wall Street Journal. And I thought about this for a long time. You know, who would do that? I don't think he hated me. He didn't even know me. What I think was happening was when he's done with the paper, he doesn't even remember that you're in the back seat. And he's not throwing it at you. You're sort of invisible. You're a non-entity until he needed you. And then he would focus on you, usually in a bad way. And, you know, the event's going to start in 5 minutes. And he's agitated because he doesn't know what to say yet. So he says, okay, what am I saying here? I would say, all right, this is the such and such event. I think you should say, no, don't tell me I think you should say. I'm not going to stand up there and say, I think I should say. Just tell me what I'm going to say. Go. Okay. Maybe, no, don't say okay. Just tell me what I'm going to say. Start talking. Come on, I don't have time here. So I would have to immediately pretend to be him in front of him and another couple of staffers who are scared to say anything. And of course, you're going to sound like an idiot. So I would say, we've gathered today to celebrate the life and work of, can you say next? Okay, that one didn't work. So I would try Winston Churchill, spent the years leading up to the Second World War. Next. Nobody wants a history lesson. Okay, I really thought you would have liked that one. Next, come on. Go to number three. Recently, there was an Olympic downhill skier. Come on, nobody wants to hear about skiing and mishaps and stuff. Come on, next. James Madison, what's next? So I would go through my entire list in some cases and say, look, Governor, I'm out. And on the way to work in the morning, I would be ready to vomit. You just knew that some disaster awaited every day.
Barton says that every night he would come home and unload his woes onto his wife. How he knew he was a good writer, but how nothing he ever did seemed to please this one man who it was his job to please.
And she kept saying to me, you need to start writing badly. But I just couldn't bring myself to do it. For one thing, I had this sense that the governor knew bad writing when he saw it, unless he had written it. And I thought, if I write badly, he'll know it, and he'll fire me. On the other hand, you know, I began to sense that he was going to fire me anyway. So I decided to figure out how he writes badly and write in that way. And that's when I began to notice these patterns.
The patterns were words, phrases.
A level of, in this regard, speaks volumes.
Anything the governor liked to use.
Given the fact that none other than.
And reuse.
A level of.
That didn't seem to mean anything.
In which you operate.
At all.
One of his favorites, the word larger, you know, a larger notion. The phrase was so common that if you weren't sure he would approve a press release, somebody would say, just stick a larger notion in there somewhere and it should be fine.
And this is how Barton kept his job. Because the more he used these words and phrases, even though he knew that they were just pure rhetorical deadweight, the less the governor hated his work. For example, maybe he had to write a letter.
And it was a stupid little letter to some kid who had, I don't know, got an award for playing the tuba or something. And what I would want to say is, that's a remarkable honor for you, and I wish you the best of luck. But I would look at that line and think it's not long enough. And I would end up with something like, that's an incredible honor for you, and I do wish you the best of luck as you sharpen the remarkable talent you so obviously possess in spades.
Did you ever worry that, like, that your own writing skills would be, like, permanently marred from this?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it created a kind of rhythm in your head, but I can sort of see now that he had a point. Because on a paper from a politician written to a kid, it looks warmer because what you needed was feeling instead of strict truth, which is probably somehow a metaphor for politics.
What Barton's getting at is that if you're a governor or a mayor or a president, you're always expected to have something more to say, to fill the silence. So all that rhetorical deadweight, those empty phrases, they're actually really useful for a politician.
Because innumerable things go wrong in the world every day. And so the poor guy is expected to have some position on potentially anything in the world at any time. But you can't say, oh, we don't have any comment. It creates a bad vibe. So you're trying to avoid saying nothing. And so you say something, but really it's not, content-wise, it's nothing. So, you know, at the end of it, he did understand political language and the way it works. It was a process of trying to admit that, maybe to myself.
Also, keep in mind that Barton still agreed with a lot of the governor's policies, thought he was doing a good job governing. So the guy's personality deficits, the fact that maybe, okay, he wasn't the best writer in the world, maybe that didn't matter so much.
It was weird. On one level, I really couldn't stand him. He's pretty much a jackass, and I didn't want to ever see him again. And on another level, he was accomplishing things. He was treating the job of governor seriously. He was principled to the point where he himself would suffer politically. So to me, and I think to other staffers, as much as we disliked him, there was something that we could not help admiring about him at the same time.
Now, up to this point, we've told you that Barton was simply working for the governor of a small southern state. Haven't said which one. But after what happens next, unless you were like in a coma or stuck in the Antarctic in 2009, you're going to know which governor we're talking about.
So one day, you know, we're sitting in the office and a friend of mine told me that the governor had gone missing, and I didn't think much of it. Presumably he's somewhere and he's fine. He's a big boy. He can handle himself.
But then someone came in and said that the state law enforcement agency had put out an APB on the governor. In other words, he wasn't just missing anymore. He was more like a missing person.
And I immediately thought of this note that he had given me. And it was in his own handwriting. And he said, keep this for me and don't lose it. And he told me it was important. And it said, once upon a time, there were three little pigs. And the time came for them to leave home and seek their fortunes. Before they left, their mother told them, whatever you do, do it the best you can, because that's the way to get along in the world. So, okay, that's weird. And we did sit around and theorize about where he could have gone or what he was doing. But it was still a joke. I remember the phrase, we were using it a lot, slow news day. There's a phrase I'm not going to use again.
A political mystery in South Carolina. The Republican governor in that state has disappeared.
It's the case of the missing governor.
Missing for 6 days.
When he left his family, security detail, and cell phone behind and struck off on his own.
The lieutenant governor didn't even know he was going away.
I don't know whether they know where he is or whether they don't know where he is, so I don't know what to tell you on that because I don't know.
So who's in charge in South Carolina? Well, that's a good question.
Therefore, I, Stephen T. Colbert, hereby declare myself the new governor of South Carolina.
And then the press release went out at a weird time, like 10:30 at night. It said that he had been hiking on the Appalachian Trail. I think when I saw Appalachian Trail, I thought it's the sort of thing that he would do. And I'm pretty sure, no, I am virtually 100% certain that the communications director and the chief of staff believed that's where he was. But the fact that he was coming back tomorrow to hold a press conference didn't sound good either. The next day, there were hundreds of reporters everywhere. And usually I would be sort of running a press conference or, you know, pretending to run it. And I had nothing to do with this one. So I just stood there with the reporters wondering what in the world he was going to say. And the governor showed up, kind of made his way to the podium, cameras clicking, and he started off.
I won't begin at any particular spot. Let me just start with
And it doesn't make any sense.
I don't see it. Where's Gina?
Watching the video of the press conference now, it's clear that the governor is doing something that's almost unheard of in modern politics. He's winging it.
I had a conversation with Gina.
And I've watched it since again, and it's, I mean, it's just a wreck. And, he started rambling about
my love of the Appalachian Trail. I used to organize hiking trips, actually.
Trips he took as a Boy Scout, and
soccer coach,
he kept saying that he was going to tell it like it was.
I'm a bottom line kind of guy. I'll lay it out.
But he's just going around and round.
I guess where I'm trying to go with this is that there are moral absolutes.
And finally, he said the words,
I've been unfaithful to my wife.
I've been unfaithful to my wife. And I thought, oh, so we're doing one of those things. And I work for one of those politicians. So I just went back to my desk and sort of sat there numbly. And it was being broadcast live in our office on Fox News. And I could sort of hear what he was saying. And
at that point, we went into serious overdrive.
It just,
and
it never stops.
So it had been back and forth and back and forth.
The governor, although he really didn't need to, went out of his way to explain that he'd been having an affair. It turned out with a woman named Maria in Buenos Aires. That's where he'd been all this time without telling anyone. That he had real feelings for her. And that he was on some kind of heart odyssey.
And so, oddly enough, I spent the last 5 days of my life crying in Argentina.
And the comms director had to physically go up and pull him by the shoulder away from the podium to get him to stop.
Will you resign as governor?
And from that point forward, it was kind of like the governor had some kind of weird political logorrhea. He just didn't know when and didn't seem physically capable of shutting up. And all that political non-speak he loved to use, it was gone.
This was a whole lot more than a simple affair.
This is from an interview he gave to the AP just 2 days after the press conference.
And that's when he came out with this crazy stuff about his mistress was his soulmate and it was a love story.
A forbidden one, a tragic one, but a love story at the end of the day.
And so, yeah, of course, that made our job infinitely harder. And I already didn't like him, but at least I felt he was principled, and now he wasn't even principled. He's just a big liar.
Barton's job now mostly consisted of scrubbing letters and press releases of potentially incriminating words. The governor's office could no longer use terms like integrity, loyalty, values. Other phrases were now just too funny to use. Phrases like foreign affairs or hiking interest rates.
He had a letter that would go out to couples who had been recently engaged. Just don't say anything weird, he said. So I had to write a full paragraph about the importance of marriage without in any way mentioning actual marriage. And at one point, I drafted a release, and it said something about an honest look at the numbers. And he came in to the office, and he said it looked pretty good, but he pointed to that line and said, maybe take out the thing about an honest look, because I'm not really somebody who should be lecturing people on honesty. And he said it with kind of a sad look, and at that moment, I felt maybe I could forgive him.
Scandals are funny things. The scandalousness of a scandal tends to decay. It always seems important at the start. People feel hurt, but then time passes. People stop talking about it. And in politics, if something isn't being talked about, it doesn't exist. So Barton, after a while, he started to have hope that all this would pass.
It was a while after the scandal, and you know, you could almost start to see light. And we were doing a press conference on some piece of legislation, and there were four or five lawmakers were behind the podium with him. It was very, you know, gubernatorial. You know, he seemed to be back to the business of being governors. And in that instance, there were a couple of questions from the press were actually about the issue. And then this AP reporter raised his hand and said, are you still seeing her, your mistress, Maria? And I watched it all. You could see the look on his face, and his instinct was to sidestep the question. But there was something about hearing her name, Maria, that he just couldn't help himself. And he started to answer it. And he said, something like, well, it's not going to be easy to maintain a relationship across that distance, but we're going to try to work through that. And, all the news of the thing was gone, and the reporters are furiously scribbling down their answer. And the lawmakers who had joined us at this press conference started sort of sneaking away. They wanted nothing to do with this. But the AP guy, he wanted the details. So he really started pressing the governor and saying, so just to be clear, you are still seeing her. And you could see the governor trying not to answer but wanting to answer. And he said, the obvious is the obvious. And at that point, you realize, okay, so he's actually going to talk about his mistress. After the press conference that night, I was still in the office by myself, and the governor came in, and I hardly ever had any time with him, just one-on-one. But in that instance, he just sat down, and he seemed to want to talk. So he finally said, how do you think that went? And, a lot of things went through my mind. And I finally said, well, when the AP reporter asked you whether you were still seeing her, you should have just said, you know what? I'm not here to talk about my personal life. Sometimes you should just say what every other politician would say. I said, do you realize Michael Jackson died the day after it all happened? And the whole thing would have been buried. But you just had to be different and say something weird.
Were you surprised at yourself with your own frankness with him in this moment?
Yeah, because it was one of the last things I ever said to him. And I'd never done that before with him. But what I said was true. And he thought about it. And after a while, he said, I'm always looking for language that's... And he couldn't think of the term. Language that's somehow larger. I remember that the word larger was one of his favorite expressions, but larger than what? I didn't know. I did feel that he never could quite put into words his own vision and outlook. And I think that's always the struggle for people who have big ideas, but they never can quite be satisfied with the language they're able to describe it with. And that was his frustration, because I couldn't find that language that was somehow larger. It was just, at the end of the day, it was just language.
Big thanks to Barton Swaim. His memoir of time in the rhetorical trenches is called The Speechwriter, A Brief Education in Politics. Find it wherever books are sold. And just a note before we continue, we edited the tape of South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford's press conference to fit our story, but you can find links to the entire excruciating 18-minute version and to Barton's memoir on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original sound design for that piece was by Renzo Gorio. It was produced by Joe Rosenberg. Now, when the Snap Judgment, a Loss for Words episode continues, death and taxes. I know, but trust me, Snap rocks death and taxes in the coolest way possible. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Loss for Words episode. Today, we're celebrating the myriad times when you don't know quite what to say. But what if you're not even speaking the same language? Through the magic of mystical transliterative negotiation, we've saved you the very best seat in the house. Snap Judgment, live. This story contains a smidgen of coarse language.
Put your hands together for Daya Lakshmi Narayana.
I'd only met her a few times, but she was gonna come and live with us.
my 4'10", plump-faced, half-moon, gold-rimmed glasses grandmother. She was coming from India to take care of me and my boring younger baby brother. Pati, which means grandma, so how was your trip? How was the flight? She says a couple words. Good, fine. But then she says, but I am suffering from romantic pains. Romantic pains? See, my grandfather had died years ago and she'd been with nobody else. So my mom was like, what are you saying? What does this mean? Don't you know what pain is? Here and here and here and here. Finally, we figure out she means rheumatic pains. But in the Lakshminarayan household, we can't let it go. It's too good of a joke. Hey, Pati, would you like a Tylenol? Or maybe a white boyfriend for your romantic pains? And Pati laughs because she has a great sense of humor. She's wonderful. We settle into our routine. My mom and dad go to work. My brother boring and sleeping. But Pati and I become obsessed with American television. Pati, Price is Right is on! Come on down! And Pati stops everything she's doing in the kitchen to come sit down next to me to watch The Price is Right. She has a platter of cookies with her, except in India, they're called biscuits. But Pati can't say biscuits, so she calls them bitches. Bitchy? One bitch? Good bitch? Bad bitch? I'm not even allowed to say this word. But I'm like, where are my chocolate chip bitches at? Pati, look, look. Bob Barker is on TV. Silver Fox Bob Barker. Do you have romantic pains for Bob Barker? And Pati laughs. Although I don't think she really quite understands the concept of The Price is Right, because a show that's based on items having a fixed price is completely foreign to her. They should ask less for the soap, less for the soap. At meal times, I ask Pati to come sit with us. No, she says. She eats leftovers and eats after everyone else, even though she's made fresh food. She does our laundry in the machine, but for her saris, she washes them in a bucket, a plastic bucket, in the basement. And she line dries her clothes. When my aunties come over with brand new saris for her, she clips off a corner or she sticks it in a little bit of bleach. Or she says, no, you wear it first. One day, I hear whispering when I'm playing alone, so I decide to sneak up on my grandma. I look at the crack between the door and the kitchen, and I hear, a-cha-cha-cha-cha. Pati has her hands on her hips, and she's whispering in the sky. A-cha-cha-cha-cha. Then she starts yelling, a-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. Buddha! Then she raises her voice, Buddha!
Water!
Artie. Who are you talking to? Artie straightens up, fixes her glasses. Iden mo anore manasik tonite. Which means, it's in my heart. It makes me feel better to say it out loud. But the whispering doesn't go away. I was playing in the snow with my friends, and Patti opens the front door. Her breath makes puffs of smoke in the cold air, and she starts a loud, long conversation with someone who isn't there. I try to look away, and my friends can't stop but stare. Isn't that your grandma? Yes. I wait till I go home, and I hide in the closet until I hear my mom's car pull up in the driveway. I run out crying. Amma, Daya, why are you crying? What's wrong? Amma, why does Patti have to live with us? Because she's family. She takes care of you and your brother. She's happy. Did something happen? No. Yes. She wears poor clothing. She doesn't eat with us. She doesn't like any flowers that I bring her. She says no. And she talks. No, she yells at her imaginary friends that aren't there. Oh, is that it? My mom says. Okay, I will tell you. So then my mom tells me, my Patti, my grandmother, became a widow at the age of 28 when my grandfather died, leaving her with 5 children. And in that society, widow, bad luck, evil omen, to be boxed up and sent back to her family, never to marry again. No jewelry. No dot on her forehead, no colorful clothing, no new saris. She could never educate herself, and her job was to sit and make the patties using cow manure. I get it. My Patti talks out loud sometimes because it makes her feel better. I wish I could fix what was in her heart. But luckily, my uncle visited from Chicago, and he had a friend who was a psychiatrist who spoke Tamil. I don't know if you've heard the old joke about these two guys who speak Tamil, and they walk into a bar, and one guy says to the other guy, actually nobody knows because nobody speaks Tamil. There's nothing, no joke there, nothing. We're so excited because this is so rare. So Patti starts going to Chicago. She's able to open up and tell her story to this man, accept help, and even except medication. Her whispering gets softer. The yelling stops, and she starts smiling again. And by the time that I go off to college, Patti says to me, blessing, blessing, because already I've achieved what she could not, an education beyond 7th grade. I was in college trying to sleep in on a Saturday morning when I got the call from my mother. Patti suffered a massive heart attack. She's in open heart surgery right now. This was my party. I had to take some time off from college. I flew to Ohio to be with her. And I got a call from my dad, who said, I just read a study, and the medication that is helping the voices could be weakening her heart. But I didn't know how to explain this to Patti. How do you explain trade-offs when there's no word in Tamil for antipsychotic? The next heart attack came quickly and swiftly in the middle of the night, and it struck down her tiny frame next to the Monopoly board game she was playing with my little cousin. She died a month before her birthday, 50 years after my grandfather passed, with whom she had 10 years of happiness before becoming a widow. At the funeral, the women in the family, my mom, my aunts, my female cousins with good jobs and good education, we put the glasses on her nose. We dressed her in a beautiful, bright, gold and magenta sari. I see the flowers coming in, and like a crazy woman, I put all the buds in my hands. I take the flower petals. The women join in. There's flowers all over her hair, on her chest like a necklace, anywhere we could find to put in her sari, flowers everywhere. I put one in her hand. Patti, take this. You could not accept this from me in life. Take it now. Take the flowers. Take the earrings. Take the bangles. Take it, Patti. Take it. Be colorful. Be in the light. Be bold. Then I whisper a blessing to my Patti. Blessing, blessing. Then I turn my head up to the sky, say it a little louder like she would have, blessing, blessing, Patti. And I think about her stories, her bitches. And that silver-haired fox, Bob Barker. I hope it goes away in your wrists, in your fingers, in your knees, in your joints, in your heart. Patti, let there be no more romantic pains.
Daya Lakshminarayanan. The original music for that piece was composed by Alex Mandel and performed by Alex and the Snap Players, David Brandt and Tim Frick. You can see this performance in Technicolor Magic on our website, snapjudgment.org, where you can subscribe to the podcast and get the full Snap Judgment Live in Oakland show for yourself. Snap Judgment and chill. When the Lost for Words program continues, we're going to the place where nobody never says nothing. Almost nobody. The Snap Judgment episode will be back in just a moment. Stay tuned. From WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Lost for Words episode. My name is Glenn Washington. Now, there are lots of reasons why a person might not have something to say. Here's one of them. Snap Judgment.
Internal Revenue Service, please hold. Internal Revenue Service, please hold. Internal Revenue Service, please hold.
Say, Doris, what are you doing when you get off later?
Same as yesterday. Working.
You're always working. Gotta lay off those extra shifts. There's no shame in clocking in at 9 a.m. and out at 1 a.m. just like anyone else.
Maybe you can afford to work a regular 16-hour day, but down here in the secretarial...
Hey, you don't want to end up like Frances. I heard she worked 300 hours straight before finally succumbing to seat rash.
Frances doesn't have a life.
Which is why I'm telling you, I know a place with a great 5 a.m. happy hour.
The Steinbergs are waiting for you in room 9.
Oh, God, that's right. Look, 5 a.m., be there for a change.
Yeah. Internal Revenue Service, please hold. Internal Revenue Service, please hold.
Mr. Steinberg, Mrs. Steinberg, I'm so sorry to keep you waiting.
Waiting? That's an understatement.
Gail.
What? Jerry, I just want to know why we're here. I need to be out of here by midnight or else I'll miss my appointment.
Well, you know, let the man speak, you know, maybe you'll make it.
Again, my apologies, ma'am. My name is Jack. I work here at the IRS, and I just wanted to ask you and your husband some questions about your income.
Income? Well, love, what do you want to know?
Well, first, Mrs. Steinberg, you work at the Federal Savings and Loans?
Uh-huh.
And Mr. Steinberg, you're registered as an HR associate at the firm Bosco & Dreyer?
Yeah, that's where I'm registered.
He registered, I registered, we're registered. Can we go?
Well, it's just, Mr. Steinberg, you haven't been reporting any income for at least a year.
Oh, that.
Wait, what? Jerry, what's going on?
I didn't want to worry you.
Were you fired? Did you get fired and not tell me?
I wasn't fired. I was laid off.
Oh, my God.
Which is fine. There's nothing illegal about getting laid off. It's just that we need to account for your time now so that we can make sure you haven't been garnering any unreported income.
I certainly hope he has. We just bought a coupe.
Well, actually, the truth is that I haven't been working for quite a while now.
Are you telling me that for the past year while I'm slaving away at that god-awful savings and loans, you're sitting at home at night all useless?
Ma'am, if you'll just let me handle this.
Good. Because now I want to know. Tell the man, Jerry. Tell him what you've been up to.
I'm busy.
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 With what?
It's complicated.
Well, in that case, let's make it simple. What were you doing last night in between, say, 8 p.m. and 4 a.m.?
Nothing.
You did nothing.
Jerry, don't be silly. Tell him what you were doing.
I'm telling you the truth. I wasn't doing anything.
This is insane. First he's busy, now he's doing nothing. Who does absolutely nothing for 8 straight hours?
Like I said, it's complicated.
Okay. I'm calling a timeout. Ma'am, if you just give me and your husband a minute alone, I think we can get to the bottom of this.
Okay. I'm going.
So she's...
Yeah.
Look, Mr. Steinberg, Jerry, I think I get it. If you've got something, someone, on the side, something personal, it's not my business. It won't go in the file. But just between us guys, you can tell me, just so I can close your case.
It's not that. It's nothing like that.
Jerry, look, you gotta give me something. Just tell me, what were you doing for those 8 hours? It can't be that bad.
You're gonna think that I'm crazy.
No, trust me, you wouldn't believe the things I've seen on this job, so I promise you, I won't think you're crazy.
Okay, it's like this. Have you ever gotten lost in thought?
Sure.
Maybe for a few minutes even?
Yeah, like anyone.
And then, you know, you snap to, suddenly you're back in the office, you hear the phones... You look up and you see your boss staring at you.
Hey, story of my life.
Right, so where did you go? Not like your body, but like you.
I don't know. Right there, I guess. I guess I didn't go anywhere.
Exactly. It's kind of like that. At around 10 p.m., 11 p.m., I'll start to feel tired. Like I'll be sitting in my chair in the living room watching a game, and the next thing I know, I'm closing my eyes.
Like blinking.
No, that's the weird part. They stay closed. Like, I can't even help it.
I don't understand. If you're tired, why don't you just eat something?
I tried. Lunch, dinner, second dinner. Nothing helps. All I know is that I just have to close my eyes, and then when I open them again, I feel better. And then I look at the clock, and all this time has passed. I mean, the first time, it was like 90 minutes. But now?
So what are we talking about here? Amnesia?
No, that's what I'm trying to explain to you. When this happens, I don't think my physical body is doing anything. But me, Jerry Steinberg, I'm not here. I'm not there. I'm just gone. I close my eyes, and for a few hours, it's like I don't exist.
What are you saying? Are you saying that you what? That you die?
Maybe. Maybe that's what death is like. To go to this place. But that's not even the most interesting part. Sometimes I close my eyes and I have these experiences. And it's almost like I've entered a new land.
A new land?
A land of the mind.
Well, Nurse Caulfield, please report to neurology. Once again, Caulfield to neurology.
Jerry, in our last session, you were telling me about your land of the mind.
Yeah, Doctor, I'm not even sure why I'm still here.
Well, you're here because you're experiencing something and you want to figure out what's going on. For example, this land of the mind, what do you find when you're there?
Well, that's the thing. It's different every time. It's like a movie that doesn't make any sense. Time, space, logic even, it's all mixed up. Like, I'll be eating an apple, only I won't remember where it came from or why I'm eating it, only that it feels familiar. And the next thing I know, the apple will be made out of toenail clippings or lots of little apples. It's hard to explain.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Well, wait, hey, what are you thinking?
Jerry, this is very promising. But before I say any more, I just want to remind you that there is no judgment in this room. This is a safe space.
Oh, safe space. If this is a safe space, then why is she here?
Jerry.
No, really, why?
Because I'm paying for it, that's why.
Mrs. Steinberg, I wanted to invite you here because I think I'm prepared to diagnose Jerry's condition.
Well, what then? What is it?
It's actually quite fascinating, clinically speaking, of course. We're lucky I was able to find it at all. I had to go back 3 editions in the DSM, but there it was, hypnoschizophrenia.
Hypnoschizophrenia.
I knew it. He's been brainwashed.
Not brainwashed, Mrs. Steinberg. Effectively, what Jerry is experiencing is a form of hallucination, a schizophrenic episode. Only his go much deeper. During the hours a person is experiencing a hypno-schizophrenic episode, he or she is both literally and figuratively losing their senses. To the outside observer, they appear totally inert, but in fact, they're in a kind of fugue state. Not only believing they're somewhere else, but often someone else, thinking thoughts that are not their own, or aren't even proper thoughts.
Jerry, that's you!
The good news is that with treatment, this can go away in time.
Away? What are you saying?
What kind of treatment, doctor?
I want to start him off on a round of haloperidol. It's a very mild antipsychotic.
It sounds expensive. Is it generic?
Actually, I just happen to have a free sample right here from the manufacturer.
But I feel fine.
It's quite new, but I can assure you it's already provided great results with a wide variety of related conditions.
Are either of you listening to me? I don't need any drugs.
Jerry, hush.
No, really. In fact, I haven't felt this good in years. It's like I'm finally interested in things again. Like I'm finally paying attention. Or I don't know, present?
I'm not surprised. People who suffer from this condition often experience a kind of hyper-alertness before succumbing to their exhaustion. It can be very beguiling that way.
Why do you say beguiling? It's just nice. I don't understand why I need to be treated at all.
But Jerry, you need to get back to work. You can't just lie around like a vegetable all night. Tell him, doctor.
She's right, Jerry. Every minute you spend in one of these fugue states is a moment you're not living your real life.
But I am living. I'm more than living. When I'm in this other place, I can fly, I can see sounds, hear colors, I can talk to the dead.
But Jerry, none of those things are real.
I don't care if they're not real. Real, they're mine and they're important to me. Real, not real. Don't you see that doesn't even matter?
Now you see, Mrs. Steinberg, this is precisely the kind of behavior I was worried about. Jerry, if you could only hear yourself, you would see you're not well. And I'm afraid that without treatment, it will only get worse.
Holy Mary, Mother of God. Jerry, you have to listen to the man.
Listen to your wife, Jerry.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but I need to go. I'm very tired. I think I need to lie down.
Oh my God, it's happening again.
Please just leave me alone. I just need to rest.
That's your condition speaking, Jerry, not you.
Jerry, darling, don't leave.
I just need some rest.
I'm so sorry, Doctor. I don't know what's gotten into him.
Not to worry, Mrs. Steinberg. It's only natural for Jerry to be anxious about treatment at first. But he'll come around. You'll see. You will make sure he takes the medication, won't you?
Of course, Doctor. I just want him back to normal.
That story was sound designed by Leon Morimoto, produced by Eliza Smith, written by Joe Rosenberg, none of whom get enough sleep. It's like I think they're trying to tell me something. I'm going to pretend like I do not understand. Get back to work. I want to thank, though, the hardworking actors, our own Joe Rosenberg, Eliza Smith, and the Uber producer himself, Mark Ristich, Avery Truffleman, our dear friend from 99% Invisible, played Doris, and last but never least, Dr. Bob Brody, who is in fact a real doctor. Big thanks to the whole crew. The CPB won't let me be. Let me be me, so let me see. They try to put me down when I start to rap, but they feel so empty without Snap. Get the Snap Judgment Podcast. Subscribe now because we've dropped episodes that will never air on the radio, including the Student and the Teacher special featuring Jamie DeWolf and Noah St. John. Yours for the asking right now at snapjudgment.org, on the iTunes, on the Stitcher, wherever you get your stuff. We're on the Facebook and the Twitter. This program was put together by myself and those artful Dodgers. Show him some love. The Uber producer, Mark Ristich. The silencer, Pat Lassini Miller. Anna, open book Sussman. Joe, the secret keeper Rosenberg. Eliza, no justice Smith. Nancy, no peace Lopez. Davey Can Do Kim, the howler. Renzo Goria. Leon, the host whisperer. And Jasmine Aguilera just speaks louder until you understand. Perhaps you've heard me say that this is not the news. No ways is news. In fact, you could get yourself one of those ventriloquist dolls. Take it home, and when the thing starts chasing you around the house with a meat cleaver, know that it's your fault for getting a ventriloquist doll in the first place. What is wrong with you? And you'd still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNY.